call this meeting of the House Military and Veterans Affairs Committee to order. Let the record reflect that it is 1:08 p.m. on Thursday, February 8, 2012. Present with us today is Representative Sadler, co-chair, Representative Gatto, Representative Lynn, Representative Cisna, and Representative Miller, and myself, Representative Thompson. Before we start, would you please turn off your cell phones? Even on vibrate, they can interfere with the equipment in this room. It's the most sensitive room I think we've got. In today's meeting, we'll be hearing House Bill 281 by Representative Thomas. It's an act establishing March 30th of each year as the Welcome Home Vietnam Veterans Day. It's my intention to hear this bill today and to move it out of committee if it is the will of the committee. We're also going to hear House Bill 234, another bill by Representative Thomas, an act relating to picketing and protests at a funeral. It's also my intent to hear this bill and move it out of committee if the committee so agrees. Our first order of business today is House Bill 281, an act establishing March 30th of each year as Welcome Home Vietnam Veterans Day. Introduce the bill, House Bill 281, is Aaron Schroeder of Representative Thomas's office. Mr. Schroeder, please go ahead and put yourself on the record and we'll hear the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm Aaron Schroeder, staff representative Thomas. Thank you for introducing me, and it's my pleasure to talk about House Bill 281. Last year, the U.S. Senate designated March 30th, 2011 as Welcome Home Vietnam Veterans Day. It marked the 38th anniversary of the withdrawal from U.S. combat and combat support units from Vietnam. Much like the bill is entitled, our proposal today is that we establish March 30th in line with the federal designation last year that we propose that March 30th of each year would be designated as Welcome Home Vietnam Veterans Day. It would be observed by suitable observances and exercised by civic groups and by the public. We're not looking at a state
ceremony
holiday for this. Holiday. Thank you. Are there any questions from the committee?
Thank you. Yeah, does the committee have any questions of Mr. Schroeder? Representative Lynn?
Well, I don't have a question, just a comment. I had the honor of being in Vietnam on March 30th of 1973 on ceasefire day before that, and we finally was due after that, and so it's a day that I'll remember for a long, long time. Many stories I can tell about that, but I won't bore the committee with it now.
Okay. Representative Sadler.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Aaron, just curious, other states that might do this, what are the kinds of, what are the range of kinds of observances, or what kind of activities might be appropriate on Welcome Home Vietnam Veterans Day?
Through the chair, Representative Sadler, I imagine what we'd be seeing is a lot of veterans groups having, like your typical VFWs having a service, and possibly younger veterans appreciating this day for the services that the Vietnam vets have done for the veterans community. They've been a very outspoken group for the veterans community, and I think a lot of the privileges and lessons that I've learned during Vietnam have been definitely appreciated and by the younger veterans, for especially post 9/11.
Follow-up question. Go ahead.
And maybe a statement more so than a question. I've been privileged to be at a number of fallen warrior ceremonies at different Veterans Day's events and deployments and so forth, but I would encourage the observances to be on a positive, upbeat, welcome home, a happy occasion as opposed to the glum and somber. There's enough of that. I think we need to express our welcome home and be happy about it. So, thanks.
Absolutely. That's the intent.
Further committee questions? Any questions of the sponsor, Representative Thomas, who we have captive in any room yet? Okay. We'll open it up to testimony. Representative Thomas, you want to put yourself on the record there, and we'll hear your testimony.
Thank you, Chairman Thomas Thompson, members of the committee. I'm Representative Thomas from District 5, Haynes, and I'm here to speak in support of my bill. I am one of 2.5 million soldiers who served in-country in Vietnam. And for the record, there was three of us in the House, Representative Lynn, Representative Grunberg, and myself. We had four, and then Richard Foster passed on us, so very few of us around. But just for the record, we also had, you know, some of our friends died there. It was 58,272 passed away in Vietnam. And I call them boys because when I was there, I got there in January of 68. I was 20 years old. When I left there in November, I was the oldest guy in the platoon that I was in, and I was 21. Everybody else was 18 and 19. So even though, to me, people said I was a man, I still felt like I was still a young boy. And the youngest was that got killed in Vietnam was 15. And so it's shocking stats. And 25,000 of those who were killed in Vietnam were 20 years old or younger. So these were boys that were in that zone. Of that, in Alaska, we lost 57 that were killed in action from Alaska. And of that, I probably know 10 of the families and have very close personal friends that were killed there. And it was helped several years ago naming the multipurpose building here at the university for Donald Spurl and Gamble with Representative Katula after two boys who were killed in Vietnam. And one of them was my very good friend. There were 39 sets of brothers who were killed in Vietnam. Now, this is not just for the in-country Vietnam veterans, Mr. Chairman, but also all the veterans in all services who served from roughly 1964 to 73, March 30. And March 30 is not the day that I got discharged, so it's not the date I picked. I got discharged the night before Thanksgiving in 68. So put that myth to bed. But we recognize, this will recognize the Navy, Air Force, Army, Marines, Coast Guard, I think even NOAA's military, any military person who had served there will be recognized on this date. And even though you didn't serve in Vietnam, you didn't know if you're going to go there. If you're lucky, you got to go to Germany or to France or stayed in America. But irregardless, you know, I was drafted. I had no choice. He just waited. After I made my rounds of the forts in different places in America, and I got my orders to go to a restricted base overseas. And there was only two then. It was Korea and Vietnam. But we knew when they took us to Fort Campbell, when the whole division was going where we were going. So this is to recognize and honor all the veterans of that era. I had a friend, and we just recently passed a memoriam for him, Larry Albecker. Was one of the first combat infantry troops that landed in Vung Tau in 1965 with the 173rd Airborne, and he had passed away. And I think it is a good tribute, even those who have passed on, that their families know that we're recognizing them for what they did. And I have a lot of friends, and I'm sure you've seen them, who have suffered from post-traumatic stress and had a hard time coming back here. Now I'm going to make a comment, because I'm going to leave in regards to the next bill and the protesting bill, because I have to leave. But I got discharged out of San Francisco. I came in the Travis Air Force Base, and just having been in Vietnam one day on an airplane in America back home the next morning or the next day, it was so confusing because we left during the day and came back across the time zone. I still didn't know when I left and came. But we came out of the, we got into the buses, and the buses had wire screens on them, Mr. Chairman. If you're in a combat zone, Mr. Lynn will tell you, the first thing you learn when you get in a situation is you look how to get out of where you're at. Well, we didn't have windows in any buses we rode in. We got in and had wire screen meshes welded to the windows, and the door in the back was welded shut. And we sat in there, and the first thing I sensed, and I knew it was panic, as we got in there, everybody's looking around, saying, what the heck's going on here? And the guy said, you'll see in a minute. And they drove, there was about five buses of us because we had four plane loads coming back same time. We got out of the Army base, I guess that was Travis Air Force Base, out into, before we got on the highway, and there were hundreds, thousands of people out there. And they started shaking the bus, throwing stuff at us, calling us baby killers. They were protesting. It was probably the happiest day of my life, being home, and they destroyed it by protesting. And so then we drove, and we went to Presidio. Does that sound right? Below the bridge, Golden Gate Bridge there, and we went through there again, and there were some protesters out there. And we got discharged at 1:30 in the morning, and this is the cute part. I came out, and there was cabs inside the compound. I jumped in a cab, and the cab driver says, "Where are you going?" I said, "I'm going to Sacramento." He said, "That's a long ways." I said, "If I go out here into San Francisco, I'll kill somebody, and they'll send me back to Vietnam." So I was in the car, and the door opens, and the guy jumps in, and the guy cab driver says, "Where are you going?" He says, "Where's the other guy going?" He says, "He's going to Sacramento." He says, "Good, because if I go downtown here, I'll kill somebody, and they'll send me back to Vietnam." And the cab driver says, "You know that guy over there?" I don't know him. I just got discharged. Literally, and you know, that was our feeling. And, you know, to be discharged in San Francisco in 68 was not the best place to go. So I took a cab to Sacramento to visit a friend of mine who had got discharged about a month earlier from Turlock Modesto. And he picked me up there. So it was just a comment of, you know, how things have changed. My staff told me, he's a captain, he did tours in Iraq. The attitude was a little different when they came home, and I think they learned from the way people taught us, were disrespectful and mean to us. And that's coming up to the next bill. I think we should be bearing our military with honors and no protesting allowed. I mean, what that did to me, the protests. And when I came home, we all had the same stories. And to this day, I tell people, you know, it's kind of another funny. I've never found anybody who didn't vote for me, and I never found a person who protested. Because, you know, we knew what we wanted to do with them, if we did know. But I think disrespectful of the next bill, coming in there to protest, you don't know what it's like to lose. You know, I never did lose a family member, but I lost a lot of friends. You don't know what it's like when you're... And you have some of your military friends. That's the way they do it. If you got killed in combat, you came home probably with your closest friend, and they came home with you. I know I got one email, and I'll just put it on the record, that this guy told me 150 feet's nothing. He said, "My rifle sighted in for 300 yards. You know, and that's the way I feel. I think, you know, we love what the men have done for us. We should honor them. You know, World War I, II, Korea, Vietnam, any war. You know, the governors choose respect. Respect the military." Thank you,
Mr. Chair.
Hold on just a moment. Representative Sisna has a question.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Sponsor. Mr. Thomas. I would like to know, I know that we have the largest percentage per capita in the nation of veterans. And can you tell me, you talked about 2.5 million people went into the Vietnam War, but how many Vietnam vets do we have? Do you have an idea on that?
No, I don't, but I do know one stat from my hometown, that we had 1% of our total population in Vietnam at one time. We had 14 boys in Vietnam, and Senator Stevens said that on the record in Congress. I know, like, the community of Hoon, I believe, is around 40% Vietnam-era veterans, and I think the number goes between 25 to 30 to 35% all veterans. And, you know, in when I came home, and we'd always get together, there was probably 18 of us that would sit around. You know, we never talked about the combat thing. We talked about jokes, what things, funny things that happened. Guard duty at night, where it's so pitch black, it's like sitting in a closet and you can't see your hand, but you're sitting there looking out for something, you know, listening for tin cans or anything scruffling. But that I know we just have a high percentage. And a lot of them in the Native community, because I got, like, a draft was back then. If you didn't join the military, went in college, you got drafted. But I was brought up as not a military brat, but all my grandfathers, uncles, they all served, and so I knew it was a thing to do. I could have drove to Whitehorse, I guess, and got out of this 40 miles away.
Representative, oh, you have a follow-up question?
Just, a real brief one, because I think the really important thing is that we have changed. I think as a nation, we have changed in terms of our understanding of exactly what our people have gone through, but especially the Vietnam War. It was a young person's war in many ways, and people gave up their lives, or they gave up a quality of life that, and part of that was because we didn't really understand. We were not as mature as a country as we needed to be. And now what we know is that as that population ages, they have much greater needs because of the difficulty of that time and because it left wounds that we need to make absolutely positive. We take care of our folks and honor the people that are in the service now. And so, and Alaskan, not just natives, but people in the communities in Alaska have played a much bigger role, as I understand it, in the military in the United States. And do you have any idea of that? Because I know historically that's always been true too, but it's almost rural Alaska in a way that has played a huge role in the military in the United States. Is that, am I right on that one?
Yes, you are, and I agree, because again, I come from a family who served in the Army and then came out. Most of them retired through the Guard. They stayed there. They're very patriotic, and again, it's your country. You have to protect it. That's where you're raised, and I think most Americans believe that. And what else? I just say, when I watch the boys come home now, and I see how they're respected. When I came home, the first thing I did in San Francisco, in Sacramento, was I got up at 6 a.m, bought a bottle of whiskey and two 6-packs of beer, and civilian clothes, and I took my patches off and medals and I threw them in the trash, the uniform. I didn't want to be seen in a uniform, but you know, I'm proud as hell today, and I tell people, you know, the American flag, they're everywhere. You know, and I'm proud of what I did. And it took a long time to recover from that. Yeah, I think sitting with the other soldiers, we always see each other, we say, welcome home.
Yeah.
You know,
did you save the trash bag?
No. I think maybe went to the Salvation Army, but I wasn't going to wear it anymore. I was afraid of what somebody would do and what I would do, because I was pretty tough back then, you know, pretty physical.
There'd been several times there in Fairbanks in the last couple of years where having lunch at Boston's or Chili's, and there'll be three or four young troops sitting there in their fatigues having lunch, and I'll try to pick up their meals a lot of times. And lately, this summer, two different times, I had the waitress come by, and I said, I'd like to pick up their lunch, and she said, somebody already has.
Yeah. What I do, Mr. Chairman, is right after the Iraq invasion started and soldiers started coming home, traveling with my wife, and there'd be three or four military standing in a corner, and I'd walk over and say, welcome home. And I'd talk to them, and my wife said, did you know those guys? I says, no, but nobody else seems to either, but I want to welcome home. And so I always do that. There's a military guy sitting there, because, you know, I don't want him to feel like he's got the plague or is sick or anything, but say, welcome home. And you can always tell which ones they are. The tradition to have the patch on the right arm, so you know they've been in combat, even if they're transferring from one base to the next, you know, you just go up and welcome them home.
Yeah, if everybody would do that in airports and other places, when they see somebody in uniform, walk up, shake their hands, and say thank you for your service.
Yep.
Representative Lynn had a question.
Well, actually not a comment, and you really spoke to it just now. I'm going to talk about the welcome home thing. It is a tradition, I think, among Vietnam veterans. You see somebody with a Vietnam patch or some identification, you go up and you say, welcome home. It's kind of a code word between us. We all, the camaraderie that we share, even though we were both in Vietnam, different time periods, different places, and so on, we share that camaraderie, having been there and not being welcomed home. I'm so proud nowadays, and I've been here in Juneau a few times, other places, where some troops come in, and people out there waving and cheering, having flags, and saying welcome home. It makes me feel good, because it was quite an experience. I didn't have quite a tough experience you did when, quote, I came home and got off the airplane, but it's not Spoon folks have now. I'm so proud of how the culture has changed a little bit, because like all military people, you join the military, whatever, wherever, and you go where they send you.
Yeah.
You don't normally ask to go there. You go where you send. You may not want to go. You know, I got orders to go to Vietnam. I had a cushy job before I got there, and I Air Force career type, and I didn't try to get out of it at all. You know, I could have done this, try to avoid it, but gosh, Air Force, if I didn't go, then somebody else would have gone in my place, and that's not fair. That's not right. So the welcome home thing is really, I'm glad it's extending beyond the Vietnam veteran community to the larger community of all the folks. You know, when we first came home, we were from Vietnam, weren't too popular, and now they, all of a sudden it seems like Vietnam veterans become kind of heroes in a way, even if we were not.
Yeah.
This is a great bill. I heartily support it, and I am a co-sponsor and glad. I wish I could co-sponsor it five times. I wish I had thought of it.
Yeah, no, thank you. I'll just make a comment in regards to that, Representative Linden. Even now, the other day I saw a man wearing a Vietnam veteran's hat at Donna's, and he got up to leave before I went to go talk to him. I wanted to know where he served and welcome him home.
Oh, do that.
Yep. If they have a hat on, it took me, it's since 68, so it was at 43 years. It probably took me 20-some years before I wanted to identify that as even a Vietnam veteran, but even though I had the flags, but now I got the bumper stickers and Vietnam veteran. I said, what the heck?
I have a Vietnam ribbon on my bumper.
Yep.
Representative, have another question? Or a comment?
Actually, a question, actually. We've heard testimony, and I think we've experienced, Representative Thomas, that we have learned as a nation, we've grown as a nation, and we've matured as a nation. The question I'm going to ask you is, do you think there will be a need in 25, 43 years, hence we'll have to have a welcome home operation, Iraqi freedom, enduring freedom, or have we changed enough this is not going to be necessary for other conflicts?
So I think, I hope you don't wait that long.
Yeah.
Hope the nation doesn't wait that long, you know, because we welcome them home, regardless, like I said, all the veterans. We say welcome home. That's where, you know, I'm the captain back here. He outranks me, but I'm his boss.
And the question I'm getting to.
Go right ahead.
Thank you. Quick one. Do you think there would be a need for this kind of thing? The question I've asked is, you know, there have been a lot of conflicts. There always seems to be war and rumors of war. So we've had Korea, had Vietnam, had Gulf 1, Gulf 2, and the OIFEF. You know, do we need to do this for each campaign, or is this... Is this Vietnam home veterans, welcome home Vietnam veterans, is this broad enough to encompass all, or is the same kind of day going to be requested for other conflicts?
No, I think each one should have their own. Each conflict was different. Those who are in Korea were cold. Where I was at was hot. I come home and I wasn't tan, I was black. I mean, it was 100-degree temperature out there and just burned all day long. So, you know, I think each one would deserve their own honor.
Now you're gray.
Any further questions from the committee for Mr. Thomas?
Thank you, Committee.
Thank you, Mr. Thomas, for bringing this bill to us.
Thank you.
I think I'll now open this up to public testimony. Is there anybody in the room that would like to come up and testify on House Bill 281 or online? We have two online. Pardon? Not on. It's on the other bill. Okay. We're back to the committee. Is there discussion among the committee members? And what are the wishes of the committee? Representative Sadler.
Mr. Chairman, I would move that make a motion that we move HB 281 version 27-LS071. Let's start again. Version 27-LS079R1/M for Mike from committee with attached zero fiscal note. And individual recommendations.
Thank you. Is there any objection? Hearing no objection, then we will have passed House Bill 281 from the House Military and Veterans Affairs Committee, and we'll take a brief intermission while we sign the sheet on it. Next on the agenda is House Bill 234, an act relating to picketing or protest at a funeral. Here to present House Bill 234 is Aaron Schroeder, staff to bill sponsor, Representative Thomas. Go ahead and put yourself on the record and make your presentation.
I'm Aaron Schroeder, staff to Representative Thomas. It's my pleasure to present House Bill 234 to the committee today. Since 1998, funeral picketing has gained popularity for groups to gain publicity for their political agenda. Increased military operations following 9/11 has unfortunately provided a group opportunity for this publicity. Currently, the state of Alaska doesn't have any guidelines for such cases. House Bill 234 would bring Alaska in line with 46 other states across the country by setting guidelines for of a 150-foot buffer from the boundary of a church, cemetery, or funeral home 1 hour before, during, and 1 hour after the service, and that those individuals who attend a funeral are members of a captive audience that warrant protection. In instances where funeral protests do occur, families are expected to conduct themselves in a certain manner. We are simply asking that asking the same of those who choose to protest.
All right. Questions of the committee for Mr. Schroeder? Mr. Lynn?
Thank
Representative
you.
Lynn.
Both.
Yes. Okay.
Look at the bill. I support the bill. I'm curious, though, you picked 150 feet, it appears, in the bill, and I got some notes here. I'm just going to ask you to respond to it. Currently, the federal law, I believe, on banning protests at national cemeteries, we have a couple here, such as Arlington, and one story I read said it said 150 feet, another one said 300 feet. In another case, your legislative research report says a buffer zone in Sage Range from 150 feet all the way up to 1,500 feet. I wonder why, you know, settle on 150 feet. And the third note I've got here, how about the length of a football field at 100 yards would be 300 feet, and people can get arrested, I believe, for going onto a football field that's 300 feet long, even if both teams are at the other end of the field. But why did we settle for only 150 feet? As far as I'm concerned, it could be 150 miles. But could you respond to that?
Through the chair, Representative Lynn, the intent behind 150 feet and how we got there was there's two parts to the federal law. There's a 300 foot buffer around the boundary
of
the cemetery, and there's a 150 foot boundary from the procession. So if the funeral procession is traveling along a route, there's a 150 foot boundary on that. We use that guideline, and also our argument is that if they're a captive audience, then there has to be a certain amount of pressure there. They have to be close to make that legal argument. If they're a captive audience and that procession is right there, then you can make that connection.
Follow-up question, Representative Lynn?
I'm a little confused because I believe in the bill it says something about a public street or roadway where you have a procession of sorts, where you have the funeral cortege, what do you want, you know, going from the mortuary to the cemetery usually. That covers that. When you say, are you talking about inside the cemetery? Because, you know, depending on where the lot is, it could be a long drive in the entrance of the cemetery to the gravesite. Is that what you're talking about?
The 150 feet only applies to the boundary. So
boundary of what?
Boundary of the funeral home, cemetery, or church.
150 feet from the cemetery, then?
Yeah, wherever their grounds.
The perimeter of the cemetery.
The perimeter, correct.
And again, though, why not a longer distance, like 300 feet, the length of a football field? That's not really, how far is it from here to that building you see out the window? I'm just a couple hundred feet?
Could be close to that.
That's pretty close if I'm grieving next to a loved one and some clown is over there with some kind of outrageous sign. I can still see him and still be I'm disturbed enough being at the funeral, let alone seeing this guy over there.
Right. Through the chair, Representative Lynn, it's a policy call for the committee. If the committee is interested in extending the buffer zone, I would ask that Doug Gardner give his interpretation of what could the consequences of that.
At the proper time, Mr. Chair, I may propose an amendment.
Okay. Further questions of the committee? Representative Sadler.
Thank you. Captain Schroeder, I'm interested on page 3, line 18 and 19, the definition of picketing. It says engaged by a person that disrupt or are undertaken to disrupt to disturb a funeral. I'm a little concerned about whether that includes some element of what someone's state of mind or intent is. Could someone claim that they're not trying to disturb a funeral, and therefore they would not fall under this law? I wonder if there's any way to. Did you consider that possibility when you drafted the language, or when the sponsor drafted the language?
Through the chair, Representative Sandler, if I'm understanding your question correctly, the boundary is 1 hour before, 1 hour after, and any that the picketing language there is geared toward, I guess, to.
Let me back up if I can.
Yeah.
But my personal opinion is that people that engage in protests at funerals, like the Westboro Baptist Church and others who engage in similar antics in the context, are maybe not so much trying to disturb a funeral as to be a little bit of publicity parasites on the attention. They're looking for attention, not necessarily to disrupt. I think they're playing off the stress and angst and grief of people as a way to get attention. So they might argue that, to the cops, no, we're not trying to disrupt the funeral. We're just trying to make a point, and they might somehow weasel out of the consequences of their actions or be allowed to get within that buffer if they're not trying to disturb the funeral. It's a word thing. I don't know. Did you consider whether this would have a test that went to someone's state of mind and intent in doing what they do?
To the chair, Representative Sadler, I don't believe when we drafted this bill, the definition there was to help law enforcement differentiate what exactly picketing means.
Yeah.
I see your point, and if Doug Gardner's online, I'd like him to elaborate on that.
He is online? Yes. We have a couple of people online. Mr. Gardner, are you there?
I sure am.
Did you hear the question from Mr. Schroeder?
I believe that the question, my name is Doug Gardner, Director of Legal Services for the committee and for the record. The question, as I understood it, was related to the mental state required with relationship to the picketing idea. And the concept that I believe Representative Sadler was asking about was that disrupt or undertaken to disturb a funeral. My understanding was the short hypothetical that Representative Sadler threw out was what would happen if somebody tried to argue that they really weren't trying to disrupt the funeral itself. Is that correct, Representative Sadler?
That's correct, Justin.
Okay. I'm sorry, I'm paraphrasing, obviously, but I guess I would say that certainly when you are in the area of drafting statutes that affect First Amendment rights, one of the things that I think is important to do is look to other cases and look at this is certainly not a process that I would suggest is highly creative, but you look at other cases where courts have allowed certain types of language, and sometimes you copy it. And one of the cases that provides for this type of language, and there are several cases out there that provide for a definition that is similar to this, but just for the record, the Phelps-Roper case versus Strickland, the 2008 case, specifically provided for this section, and it described other protest activities to mean an action that is disruptive or undertaken to disrupt or disturb a funeral or burial service. And so the law that is before you and the definition that is before you wouldn't restrict all activities. It would restrict those that are undertaken in the mental state, I think, is on page 2, line 30 and 31. The person knowingly engages in picketing. It means they're out there standing there with a sign. It's probably a pretty obvious, easy mental state to demonstrate. But the picketing is with reckless disregard that the pick, with respect to the disruption to the funeral. And so there has to be some, in order for this, a state interest, a significant state interest, I would suggest, to be demonstrated, the state has to have an interest in protecting from certain types of conduct, not just generic blanket conduct. And in this particular case, this definition would restrict disruptive. I recognize that that may be, to some extent, difficult to ascertain exactly what disruptive is. It would require a fact pattern. For example, a line of 100 motorcycles lined up, revving their engines, screaming what some people might consider to be a positive statement would violate the statute, just the same as a line of folks with signs that were perhaps a little bit more derogatory or what some people might consider more derogatory. But the statute would regulate disruption, whether it was applause or whether it was negative, what people might consider to be negative slogans or things like that. So the statute attempts to draw a narrow border around the types of activities that are being regulated, in doing so to comply with the First Amendment requirements that this not be overly broad. Sorry, that's a long answer, but I tried to answer your question.
Thank you, Doug. I'm going to paraphrase back to you. So basically, you look at First Amendment, you look at other cases, and this is language that has been passed into law elsewhere, and at least so far has stood muster before the Supreme Court.
I think it's an important point to note for the committee that the U.S. Supreme Court has yet to fully address, I know there's somebody else online, I believe, that has far more First Amendment experience than I do, but my understanding from the research I did and updated this morning, my recollection is the United States Supreme Court has not dealt with a state criminal statute regulating picketing at funerals. And so the U.S. Supreme Court has not yet visited this issue. There are several circuit courts, particularly the Sixth and Eighth Circuits, which are split on this issue, and split circuits usually suggest that the U.S. Supreme Court will take the issue up. But yes, there are the circuit court, and I believe it is the Eighth Circuit Court. Maybe I'll confirm that in a moment. But yes, this language has been found to pass constitutional muster, and in drafting the bill, obviously I was asked to draft a bill that would be constitutional and that would pass First Amendment constitutional muster, and so that's why the definition was included.
One would like to think so. So a couple other quick short follow-ups, I guess. So reckless, I have a question about the reckless. Does reckless mean that the activity is taking place within the geographical limits, 150 feet, and the chronological limits, 1 hour before, 1 hour after? Is the presumption that if any activity, protest, picket, takes place outside those parameters, that it's not reckless and therefore it is allowed?
The statute does not attempt, I want to say yes. Yes and no answers aren't always easy, but I would say yes. I would say that the statute only attempts to regulate what I would consider to be time, place, and manner in a content-neutral way. And so, as a consequence, sometime prior, outside the window or outside the geographic area, there might be other laws that might, if somebody was on a giant bullhorn in the deafening sound, it may be that there are other criminal statutes that or local ordinances that might affect that conduct. But with this statute, the statute wouldn't apply to those things.
If I could, with your indulgence, one last question.
Yes.
What are the numerical outside limits? We've heard some questions about whether a 150 feet buffer zone is appropriate or defensible. Some of the information we had said 500 feet. Are there any, can you give us any guidelines as to what the courts might look favorably upon or where they might draw the line?
Well, many of the other cases involve 300 foot buffer zones, and my recollection is that 300 foot buffer zones received a considerable amount of scrutiny. I will say that I believe that the discussion on this bill was to try and recognize that some Alaska communities are smaller. It's not Fort Worth, Dallas-Fort Worth, and some in a sprawling, you know, metropolitan area. And so I think that the idea, if I'm recalling things correctly, back a year ago when some of this work was done, that there was an effort to acknowledge that Alaska is a little different, a little smaller communities. You get some communities that 350 feet, 400 feet may be the entire Main Street. And so there was an idea that 150 feet would be more appropriate, and quite candidly, I think that it was certainly less than the buffer zones that were approved in prior cases. And so, again, it was my instructions from the sponsor to do everything possible to make sure that this complies with First Amendment law to the extent we know it.
Thanks for your answers. Thanks, sir.
Further questions? Mr. Gardner will be on the line. Do you have a question for Mr. Gardner or Mr. Schroeder?
Yes, sir. signs. You get these very egregious signs. Only good soldiers are dead soldiers. This group, that group, you name your epithet. Is that disruptive? Have some egregious sign out there that's insulting to a group or insulting to the deceased because he's a military person? Or any person?
And to Mr. Gardner?
Yes, well, whichever attorney can answer.
Mr. Gardner?
Representative Lynn, through the chair, I'll go ahead and take a shot at it. One of the things that I want to say, and this isn't a lawyer weasel-out answer here, one of the things that I want to say is that this bill and this language is drafted and would cover language like the language you just described. I believe there'd be a good argument that that's recklessly disrupting a funeral and picketing, and I believe it would fit in that definition. But the bill and the language is designed to cover language that some people might think was very positive. The concept of the bill is to, as I heard the sponsor speak earlier, Representative Thomas, the concept of the bill is to let people have a funeral in peace without people that are on either side or of an issue, whether it's maybe what pop culture would deem negative or positive. The idea is to allow a window for people to grieve, people who are captive at a funeral home or a place where a funeral is occurring, to grieve. And so I want to try and avoid responding directly qualitatively to particular slogans or things, but it's designed to protect that kind of disruptive behavior, and I suspect the example you gave would fit within the statute.
And then, follow-up question, Rick. I understand that infliction of emotional distress is a civil thing, but is there a criminal equivalent of that that this bill would cover? Because some of these signs that are out there, and something you shot, that is, to me at least, an infliction of emotional distress.
Through the chair, Representative Lynn, emotional distress certainly is a civil matter. I don't believe that is taken into account. I understand, I'm not trying to be insensitive to the results of things that happen, but those are civil matters that the criminal law, I don't believe, addresses.
That might be something to consider. Thank you.
Representative Cisna, and then Representative Gatto. Go ahead.
And thank you very much, Mr. Chair. And my question would be of Mr. Gardner. The thing that I'm thinking of on this, and the concern that I would have, is that one of the things that I've certainly been seeing a lot of is the loss of some of our constitutional rights. Now, I agree with Representative Lynn completely on the horror of someone playing off of the grief of someone else for their own for their own pleasure or just something really negative inside of them that they're working on. But at the same time, we have in communities, we have laws on things that are egregious to us that are very loud or very bold, that that actually create some kind of real impact on us. So, for instance, 150 feet, and I know that Mr. Gardner is not in the room, but I can't imagine how far that is. And one of the things that we have to think about here is how far is 150 feet if you're talking about big signs. And if it is big signs that are saying horrible things, then it would be kind of nice to have some idea of just how big is really in your face at 150 feet.
150 feet, half the distance of a football field.
Okay.
50-yard line.
Okay. And in terms of noise, how loud would that be?
Through the chair, Representative Sisson, I don't know that I can answer that question. I just don't know what a decision maker would conclude as disruptive. I think a giant bullhorn mounted on the top of a car would probably be disruptive. Somebody quietly standing at 150 feet with a sign, or just talking at a normal voice like I'm speaking with you in, would probably not be disruptive. And so I guess I just don't know the answer to that question.
Follow-up question, Representative Sisson?
Yeah, and I guess I think the thing that's really critical here is that we remember that respect is something that should be for the living, but it all should be for those of us who have passed away, and that respect. I mean, it's really important, and I've had people close to me that have gone, and as we age, that happens more and more. So I think respect is something we need to keep in our mind for those who've passed as much as those who are with us. But I think it's not a bad idea to have some fairly reasonable definitions so that we don't make it too big a space in Alaska where you've got small communities. At the same time, you don't want people taking things over. And maybe there is no definition needed, but it might be something to be thinking about.
Thank you. Representative Osterman has joined us, and Representative Gatto, you had a question or a statement there?
I do, Mr. Chairman. See if Doug can help me out here. I have First Amendment rights, too. And if I want to speak at a funeral and I'm confined to a space, and someone else uses motorcycle noise to overpower my ability to be heard or to interfere with my speech, who's trampling on whose rights?
Representative Gatto, through the chair, I'm not sure I understand. I understand that it sounds like you're referring to situations that happen where one group is trying to drown the other group out, and there's an effort to see who turns out on top in terms of either volume or message. I don't know exactly what you maybe could help me with the rephrase the question a little bit.
Okay, I'm concentrating on my personal First Amendment rights, and if someone interferes with my personal amendment First Amendment rights, they're in violation of the one of the first 10 amendments, the First Amendment. At some point, when am I allowed to exercise my free speech unhindered by their free speech?
Well, I guess I'm not quite sure how to fully answer that question. I know that the adage that the remedy for speech is speech that you don't like is speech of your own, and but I don't know how to answer that question in the context of this bill. I guess I don't know how to answer that.
So, If I can follow up.
I'm
guessing the 150-foot requirement is sufficient that whatever they're doing, my free speech is not hindered sufficiently, so my free speech is violated. And then the question that comes up, which is just a natural follow-up, is, well, if they feel they're not getting to me at 150 feet with the noisemakers they have, well, go buy bigger noisemakers. And then they will have accomplished their goal, and the 150 feet will become somewhat meaningless. Or buy bigger signs, or yell louder, or get more people, or any one of those things is possible. So I guess I'm maybe there is no answer when what are the limits that I can get? I mean, you can't get in my face and touch me, but can you get 6 inches from my face with your face? Can you get, is 6 inches too close? Is a foot allowed? You have to be 10 feet away, or 50, or actually 150. You can't touch me, and you're not touching me at 1 inch, and you're not touching me at 150 feet. And that leaves me in a quandary of, when are my rights violated? That's clear to anyone else that that's what happened.
Well, through the chair, Representative Gatto, I guess the decision on distance and the realities of both the questions you've asked and the questions that Representative Sisna asked are probably classic First Amendment questions when it comes down to trying to narrowly tailor a statute to serve a significant government interest, but yet leave ample alternative channels for communication that are protected by the First Amendment. And therein lies the balancing. And all that I can do is respond to you, and I know it's not a real satisfactory answer, but all I can do is respond to you and tell you what's gone before courts and what's been found to be too restrictive and what has been found to be a balancing the courts have been willing to accept. And I guess I gave you a range between 350 to 150 feet, but beyond that, I don't know that I can really answer the question. That's the best I can do.
Further questions of Mr. Schroeder or Mr. Gardner?
Either one. Thank you, Mr.
Eddie Miller. Go ahead.
I am a little hesitant to ask this question because I may be opening a can of worms that I really don't want. You might have already noted my name is on this bill. I've signed on. I want to say that I strongly support its intent, but I'm not sure that we're going to get there. One of the first questions I have to ask is, do we actually have this problem? Is this just an elaborate solution looking for a problem here in Alaska? Does anybody know? And I'll accept that answer from anyone.
Through the chair, Representative Miller, up to this point there hasn't been a protest that I'm aware of in the state of Alaska. No.
Okay.
Representative Lynn.
We have a lot of prospective laws. I guess, I mean, could happen. I mean, we have, you know, law against homicide.
Yes.
Maybe one that hadn't happened yet.
Right.
Might happen tomorrow.
Right.
Okay. Further questions of Mr. Schroeder? Thank you, Mr. Schroeder, for your presentation. Mr. Gardner, are you going to stay online? We might have a couple more questions.
Certainly.
All right. At this time, we'll open up open this up to public testimony. And online, we have Mr. Jeffrey Mittman from the ACLU. Mr. Mittman?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Yes, if you put yourself on the record and give your affiliations, we will listen to your testimony.
Certainly. Thank you. My name is Jeffrey Mittman. I am the Executive Director of the ACLU Alaska, and I would like to thank the Chair and the Committee for the opportunity to testify. The committee and the members should have already received yesterday our written testimony with respect to this bill. We appreciate the opportunity to add a few remarks. One, let me at the outset say that I personally and the ACLU absolutely understand and support the intent of the bill, which is to allow individuals who are grieving to be able to do so in a respectful manner. Let me also state that, for example, with respect to the members of the Westboro Baptist Church who are known to intentionally picket at funerals with incredibly offensive and hurtful language that is really ugly in the extreme, that we do not support that message and think it is highly inappropriate. That being said, as I'm sure many of the members of the committee are aware, the ACLU has a mandate which is to robustly protect the constitutional freedoms that all of us as Americans enjoy. Sometimes the protection of constitutional rights is not easy and is not pleasant. For example, in a famous case back in the 1960s, the ACLU defended the rights of Nazis to march through a Jewish neighborhood. It is not that we felt that that was helpful or appropriate activity. However, it was constitutionally protected activity. With respect to this bill, unfortunately, we believe that in its drafting, although it attempts to move in the right direction, there are some infirmities. So, for example, the last sentence of the bill describes picketing as protest activities. What a court will do in looking at a statute is first go to the plain meaning of a word. And Merriam-Webster, as we noted in our testimony, defines protest as actions which which express disrespect or disapproval. So we're immediately going into the realm of non-content-neutral legislation. And unfortunately, once you go there, that's where the courts immediately move towards very careful scrutiny. As has been noted, there's a split in the circuits. The Eighth Circuit has disapproved of these sorts of legislation. The Sixth Circuit has approved. However, our best indication is what the Supreme Court did in the intentional infliction of emotional distress case that has been referenced. And there, in I believe a 9-0 unanimous decision, the court clearly indicated its disapproval of these sorts of statutes. Unfortunately, by broadly defining the areas protected as churches, mortuaries, funerals, cemeteries, in, for example, Anchorage, we encompass large areas of traditional public forum, sidewalks, places of business, state buildings. So in the way this is drafted, it goes too far and too broad and would not be found to be an appropriate and content-neutral time, place, and manner restriction. We'd be happy to work with the drafter and with the committee in looking at remedies to this bill that could meet constitutional requirements. However, in its current form, this is too far afield. With that, I'm happy to answer any questions.
Any further questions of Mr. Mittman from the committee? Mr. Representative Sadler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Mittman, I'm going to ask you the same question I asked of Doug Gardner. In your position and with your access to information out around the state, do you have any idea as to what a defensible number for the number of feet a distance between a funeral event, accepting that that's okay language, between a protester and a funeral event? In your information, what would be an acceptable limit?
And through the chair, I thank you for your question. Representative Sadler, the issue, unfortunately, it has to be broken down into two respects. There is, for example, silent sign holding, which would be analyzed different. So, for example, if I'm holding a sign, which, again, what was at issue in the Supreme Court case, although my actions are offensive, by being silent, I am not disrupting the conduct of the funeral. Conversely, if I were standing even 3 or 4 miles away, but had some sort of technique where I could pierce the walls of the church or pierce the sound barrier of a cemetery and actually disrupt the conduct of the ceremony, that would be differently analyzed. So I'm not sure that the distance question is the best way to get at the constitutional issues. It's more at the courts will protect an individual's right to be able to conduct a ceremony. The courts will generally not, in a public place, protect an individual from hurtful or annoying behavior, even though in a situation like this, it's at a funeral where one should have the right to be left alone.
Does that bring any more questions, Representative Sadler?
It raises a few.
Representative Lynn.
Did I hear you correctly that an extremely offensive sign in this context would not be offensive to somebody at the funeral?
Through the chair, Representative Lynn, no, absolutely not. It, It is offensive. And again, I do want to reiterate, we unfortunately, we do not in any way support the ugly messages that have been used. And we do not in any respect want to diminish the offense and hurt that occurs. Unfortunately, or fortunately, depending on one's perspective, the Constitution has drawn the balance that if the offense is such that it can be avoided or is fleeting in some respect, that is protected. So an offensive sign that can be ignored or from which one's eyes can be turned or which one passes at a distance within, say, for example, a 150-foot zone would be protected. Something yelled repeatedly over and over during a ceremony, that same message in a way that disrupts or interferes with the conduct of the ceremony would likely not be protected. So it's not whether or not it's offensive, it's what form that offensive message takes.
Follow up, Representative.
Again, would this not be disruptive if I'm a grieving parent, brother, spouse? This sign would not be disruptive. It might be offensive. I think everybody agrees this would be offensive. But would this be disruptive by its very nature? It would be to me, but what about to the rest of humanity?
Through the chair, Representative Lind, and again, this is where we're getting into where the courts are very careful. I would agree that one could argue that an offensive sign, silently held, in that it causes emotional distress, is disruptive to one's appropriate and quiet ability to participate in a ceremony. However, again, looking at the Supreme Court case where the court said that there was no the constitutional protections forbade the infliction of even a civil penalty, that whether or not it was disruptive, it was constitutionally protective.
Further questions of Mr. Mittman? Hearing none, thank you very much, Mr. Mittman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Annie Carpinetti, can we ask you a question on the criminal side of things?
I didn't sign up to testify.
Pardon? Well, Mr. Gardner can probably answer what I have. Mr. Gardner?
Yes.
Yeah, this is Representative Thompson. I noticed this bill creates it as a misdemeanor, a disorderly conduct. I was just reading that there's 36 states classify it as a misdemeanor, but several states classify the second offense as a felony, and that there are two states, Indiana and Michigan, classify the first offense as a felony. What is our penalties on misdemeanor crimes, disorderly conduct? Do they vary by community, or is it just under the state?
I believe that this is a B misdemeanor. I didn't have my statute book open, and I will open it, but I believe this is a B misdemeanor, which would be punishable by a fine and certainly not more than 90 days in jail.
Ms. Carpinetti is holding her hand up.
I can't answer that question. Disorderly conduct has a maximum term of imprisonment of 10 days.
Put yourself on the record, please.
Pardon?
Put yourself on the record.
Ms. Annie Carpinetti. I represent the criminal division of the Department of Law. And I came to learn, actually, more than I came to testify. But I can help you in regard to the penalty for disorderly conduct is a maximum of 10 days in jail. It's an unusual misdemeanor.
Maximum of 10 days and fine?
Yes. I think it's 300, but I'll have to double check.
Okay.
Yeah. But it's not the regular B penalty, B misdemeanor penalty.
Mr. Sadler,
I appreciate that correction.
Go ahead, Mr. Gardner.
I'm sorry, I had my usual B misdemeanor cap on, and I think Ms. Carpinetti is right. I recognize that is a 10-day maximum, and I think she may be right on the fine as well. Thank you.
Representative Sadler.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm not sure whether to address it to Doug or Annie, but if we pass this bill as drafted currently, it passes into law, on what grounds might you expect a challenge? You know?
Through the chair, Representative Sadler, I mean, if a person were prosecuted for violation of the statute, that I think it would come up in that context, and Mr. Gardner may have a different response, but that would be my response.
Let me possibly recast the question more to the point. I'm trying to figure out, instead of playing lawyer myself and trying to ask an attorney, where would this law be weak? Where might it be subject to challenge? Where do you think it might be least strong?
Through the chair, I would defer to Mr. Gardner. Thank you.
Mr. Gardner, do you hear that question from Representative Sadler?
I did. Representative Sadler, through the chair. Well, I think that a challenge to the law would probably look a lot like materials that I was that I didn't agree with all of, but I thought were well written by Mr. Mittman, and I believe that his letter is in essence an effort to outline and be helpful to the committee to outline what the legal issues are that would be litigated. And I think that the statute on its face would be litigated. It would be litigated as to the particular facts of the situation, but I think his memo does a nice job of outlining the legal issues that would come up. And a lot of the outcome would depend, as I think Mr. Mittman suggested a little bit, on whether or not the court was persuaded, the Alaska Supreme Court was persuaded by the Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals line of cases, or the line of cases from the Eighth Circuit, an Eighth Circuit that I think is internally divided and is interested in reviewing its prior determination on a picketing statute that it found was unconstitutional. So, but a lot of the outcome would depend probably on the facts. But the arguments in Mr. Mittman's letter are the arguments that I think would come up. I guess in terms of the final part of that question, as I understood it, what is the weakness? I think that the weakness in all of the picketing cases is the question that I think the U.S. Supreme Court needs to answer. And that question is really whether or not the law of protecting, balancing free speech versus balancing interests of people to be free from interference when they associate and do things in the context of being a captive audience. And those captive audience cases seem to be an area where the courts have been divided. Is that captive audience line of case law going to be extended to funeral protests by the U.S. Supreme Court, which would have the final word on it? I think that that's an area that could be vigorously litigated in the Alaska Supreme Court, and might be the deciding factor in the cases like this. In the past, captive audience has been a little bit more limited. It's been focused on protest activities directed towards a home or in the context of abortion clinics. And I think that the court needs to talk a little bit more about captive audience case law, and we would need to know the answer to that.
All right. Further questions from the committee? Okay. Is there anybody else in the audience or online that would like to testify to this House bill? Not online. Anybody in the audience? Seeing none, we come back to the committee.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Lynn.
I'd like to offer an amendment.
Okay.
It would be a conceptual amendment. You change number 150 feet to 300 feet anywhere it appears in H.B. 334.
Object.
Okay, there's been an objection for discussion purposes. Representative Cisna.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Chair, my concern with that that amount of space in very large campuses or places where you have miles of big park and it's open spaces, or maybe if it was on near the ocean and you had you were out in a boat or something, 300 feet would be reasonable perhaps, but I think it's more space than I think you need I think that that it doesn't seem to me that that amount of space is needed. I think that just the space itself is far more than seeing or hearing would create a problem.
Discussion on the proposed amendment. Representative Gatto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think the bill is, I feel like we're on a very slippery surface, and changing the distances just increases the angle of the surface we're on that's still slippery. We want this bill to survive, then we ought to be very nervous, very careful, and almost religious about not exceeding reasonable limits. And so I'm going to be a no vote on the amendment because it's tough enough to get the bill passed in its current form, and we're just going to make it more easily challenged later on. So that's my talk.
Representative Osterman.
First off, apologize for being late. Other commitments. I'm wondering if the sponsor of the bill has a comment in reference to the 300 feet.
Mr. Schroeder, could you comment on the proposed amendment to 300 feet from the 150?
Mr. Chairman, the sponsor agrees with Representative Gatto's comments.
Pardon?
The sponsor agrees with Representative Gatto's comments.
It should stay at the
150
feet
and not be changed?
Right.
Follow-up question, Mr. Austin?
No, thank you.
Representative Sadler.
Thank you. I was actually going to propose the same kind of amendment because I thought anything worth doing is worth doing right, and 150 feet is not that much. So I don't know if you read my notes, but I was going to suggest that. But then I thought that I do understand the sponsor's desire to get it on the books and prefer to err on the side of keeping inside, well, to the extent we can, well inside what we see the bounds of constitutionality are. I was asking questions of Doug Gardner to try and figure out what that number was. And forgive me, Doug couldn't hear a firm answer, so probably best to err on the side of conservative, you know, prudence and go shorter than longer. So while I appreciate the intent, I think I would probably stick with 150 as well.
Further discussion? Do you maintain your objection?
I'm willing to drop it. I'm going to maintain.
Okay. Pardon me. Karen, I think we're going to have a vote on the amendment.
No.
Representative Gatto.
No.
Representative Osterman.
No.
Representative Lynn.
No. Yes.
Representative Sisson.
No.
Co-chair Sadler.
No.
And co-chair Thompson.
No.
I have 1 yay and 6 nays.
By a vote of 1 yay and 6 nays, we have defeated the amendment. We're back now to the original motion. Further discussion by the committee. Representative Miller.
I'm going to pose something that has me concerned. As far as I know, the rather infamous prisoner, Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, is still alive somewhere in U.S. custody, the self-admitted man who planned the 9/11 attacks. Let us suppose that he has family that lives in Fairbanks. Let us suppose that they purchase a burial plot for him at Clay Street Cemetery, a very small cemetery. Let us propose that he dies, and they intend to have him buried there.
Great idea.
Yeah. Now, I personally would not welcome such a resident in my community, especially if there was going to be, you know, a rather large stone and you know, commemorating him as some sort of martyr, etc. I might like to exercise my First Amendment rights to protest that. I might like to stand out there with a sign of my own. I might like to draw some attention to it. If we pass this as is, then I just lost my right to do that within, you know, the confines that we've described here. So perhaps we do need to look at some amended language. As I said, I've signed on to this bill, and I like its intention. I would like to see it pass, and I would like it to be able to stand up against constitutional scrutiny. But right this minute, I'm beginning to see some things that make me doubt that it could actually stand a court challenge.
Representative Miller, I appreciate your comments. personally myself, I would probably be a protester, but I would definitely respect the law and be at 150 feet, but I would have a sign saying that this shouldn't be happening here. So I would not have any problem with that whatsoever. People that try to impose their things on other people, that's wrong, and I agree with the bill itself, and I wouldn't have any problem. I'd be a protester, but
you and I would be there together.
Representative Lynn.
Well, and I would say basically the same thing, but realize the person who's dead has already suffered their fate, deserved or not. But the people who are mourning, the people who would mourn this terrorist fellow or anybody else, they didn't do it. They're the grieving family. This doesn't really protect a dead person. This protects those who are grieving, and those who are grieving are essentially innocent of any wrongdoings the deceased may have done.
Right. That's true.
I agree. Mm-hmm.
Further discussion by committee members?
Yes, sir.
Representative Sadler.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think the position of every member, I can speak for myself, my position is pretty clear. I also condemn the activities of the West Rural Baptist Church. I think it's reprehensible. I'm impressed by the willingness of the committee to consider the constitutional implications and try and pass good, defensible law. I'm not an attorney, but I remember hearing someplace that hard cases make bad law. As a former reporter, I care about the First Amendment. I know many of us here do. And so I think it's important that these questions be decided at the highest court in the land. And I also think it's important that we do maintain some consistency with other statutes that have been passed in other states, such that when it does go before the nation's highest court, the position of the states can be clear, and whatever decision the nine old men and a couple old ladies make will be appropriate for the entire nation. I didn't mean that by anything. The justices, rather. So I'm going to support the bill and would not be surprised if it does end up back in the Supreme Court. I'll look forward to that decision. Thanks.
Further discussion? Okay. Is there a motion to move House Bill 234 with zero physical note to Representative Lynn?
Yes, Mr. Chair. I'd be pleased to move HB 234. That's my glasses is not here. 274506-27-D. I hope I'm passing
and
the right
27-LS0627-B.
With individual comments and any fiscal note.
Individual recommendations?
With individual recommendations.
Is there any objection from the committee? If not, then House Bill 234 has passed House Military and Veterans Affairs Committee. Our next Military and Veterans Affairs Committee meeting will be next Thursday, February 16th at 1 p.m. And at this time, at 2:37 p.m., I adjourn today's House Military and Veterans Affairs Committee.